my name's Chris Gates. I'm an addict and alcoholic. And I've been sober since October 5th of 1998, and nobody's more surprised about that than me. I say I'm an addict and alcoholic. You guys have heard a lot of the story, but I'm going to sort of spread it out linearly. Use your words, Chris. I say addict and alcoholic. What that means is I'm a binge drinker and a low-bottom heroin addict. Regardless of anything else I tell you over the course of my story, I'm essentially a nice boy from a good family. There are portions of my life where that is not very apparent. You know, I just went to a get-together with a friend of mine, a photographer from back in the early 80s who was living in Austria, and he came back because he's working on a book and he wanted me to do some stuff with it. And it was with a group of people, and one of them actually said something to the effect of, like, I was sort of the best possible version of who they always thought I was going to be, but they didn't see me ever in the 90s. So they had no idea who that guy was. A lot of you guys know my take on recovery is different than a lot of people. It's very practical. I don't believe shit. I don't think belief is a necessary component to this. I think action and experience is what this is about. I have a systems analyst mind. I'm also a little bit on the Asperger's scale, so you take that, you know. I'm trying to work with it. I come from a very loving and supportive family. You know, nobody ever did anything weird to me. I was a happy little kid until the first day of first grade. And then I went to school, and there's 28 other kids there, and those kids made me uncomfortable. And so I came home and I started eating, because there was no drugs or alcohol in my house. Nobody drinks in my family. But there was little Debbie's. And so I started eating. You know, I was with the same 28 kids for 6 years, and I never developed any meaningful friendships. I had a lot of proximity buddies, people who I was close to while I was around them. But as soon as I came home, I never saw them. And I didn't live anywhere near anybody in my school. It was just me and my brother and one other kid. And I didn't know that was weird. Apparently that's weird. That follows me through my whole life. I don't make friends easily. It doesn't occur to me that I'm supposed to. I don't know how. It doesn't come naturally. I don't know how much of that's part of my disease and how much is part of my makeup, but it is. So I'm eating. I was always told I started putting on weight in grade school because I was such an active boy, and now you have to sit all day, and that was a great story, and it's total horseshit. I can look back now and spot the first presence of the malady at 6 years old. And so I began to eat. And, you know, then I went to middle school, and we moved like six blocks between sixth and seventh grade, and I ended up going to a middle school that's a different middle school than everybody else I went with. And you know, I understand now, having had daughters who went through the middle school experience, that middle school is essentially a holding pen for hormonal lunatics. And even the head cheerleader and the president of the student council feel different and weird on the right day. But I was different and weird. At 7 years old, I saw the Rolling Stones on Ed Sullivan in 1968 and knew that I wanted to play guitar in a rock band from that moment forward. And I grew up right by the UT campus, and I was surrounded by hippies, and I started buying records at garage sales. I didn't even care what they were. Just, I'm obsessed with music from 7 years old on. So I get to middle school, and everybody there hasn't really even discovered the AM radio yet, and I'm walking around with a mono tape deck with big old D batteries in it and an earphone, listening to Black Sabbath and, you know, trying not to hate everyone around me. And I started going to a lot of concerts in seventh grade. And I'd go by myself because I didn't know anybody who wanted to go. My parents would just drop me off at the Armadillo or the Coliseum or whatever, and I'd go in. And shockingly, there was a lot of marijuana smoking in 1973 at concerts in Austin. And in the beginning, it was weird. Like, everybody's passing these things around. I don't know what to make of it. But after four or five concerts, they didn't seem like bad people. And they handed me, and I started trying it. And, you know, it turned out that there was a guy that sold pot right next door to one of the guys on the school bus with me, and so I started smoking a ton of weed. You know, it went real good with the food. I'd get off the bus and smoke a joint and stop at the Minimax and buy an entire Boston cream pie and eat it on the way home, you know. And then high school rolls around, and by the time I'm in ninth grade, I'm 6 feet tall, I weigh 220 pounds, I have hair down to here and the beginnings of a beard, and the drinking age is 18. So getting alcohol is a non-issue. But my disease hadn't presented itself at all in any meaningful way yet. You know, some people, my wife was blackout drinking at seven. That's not my truth. My story is I drank and I used for a long time, and it was really fun. And then I drank and I used for a number of years, and it was still fun, but there were starting to be problems. And then I drank and I used, even though I didn't want to, for a number of years, and it was nothing but consequences and misery. And then I died 4 or 5 times, and then I got sober. But back then in high school, it was working. I was enjoying myself. You know, I began to discover things like LSD, which are entertaining. And I'm drinking, always more than I mean to, though. And I get out of high school. I graduate high school with hair down to here and a giant fucking beard. And 2 months later, my hair is this long and blonde, and I'm in a punk band. You know, I discovered punk rock my senior year of high school because rock and roll had gotten a little bit tedious by 1978 and 79. And I discovered the punk scene that was happening in my neighborhood in Austin. And immediately put a band together with a bunch of my skateboard buddies and started playing. And it was awesome. I found my people. It was like the island of broken toys. You know, these are my people. And everybody there is drinking a lot of beer and smoking a lot of weed and having a good time. And there's some people over there, and they're doing a bunch of speed. And they kind of freak me out a little bit. But by the time I'm 21, I'm drinking so much on a regular occasion that I'm passing out. And not in a pretty way. You know, my friends like me, but they can't get my dead weight back to the car, so they roll me on my stomach so I don't pull a Hendrix and just leave me where I fall. And I start waking up in the front yard where the party was, or in the alley behind the Lazy Daisy Diner on Guadalupe, or just wherever I drop, that's where I wake up. And my solution to that was never to go, wow, I should watch my drinking. And that literally never occurred. What did was I just buddied up to the guys doing meth. Because I'd gotten to know them, and they weren't bad guys. You know, now some of them were using needles, and they freaked me out. But I got to know them, and they weren't bad guys. And the band I'm in is doing really well. We're making records. We're touring the country. You know, I'm having a great time. And the first band runs its course. And the next band I get in, our motto is show up drunk, show up late, don't show up at all, and please bring meth when you come. And that band was hugely fun. We were having a great time. But we weren't that popular in Austin, but we were really popular on the West Coast. And so after one tour out there, I went to the singer who was my roommate and said, we should move to California. And he went, well, I'm on probation for DUI, so I can't go anywhere right now. I waited for a while for him to get off probation, and it became apparent he wasn't going to go anywhere. And I went out to L.A. to visit and ended up going to a party where some friends of mine's new sort of rock band played, and then a band called Faster Pussycat played, and then Guns N' Roses played their fourth show in a room about half this size for about 30 people, and I went, I'm moving to L.A. The punk scene was tedious, and I wanted to play rock and roll. So I packed all my crap, and I moved to Los Angeles. And 2 weeks after I got there, I met this beautiful goth girl who was dealing the best crystal meth I had ever seen in my life. And it was love at first 7-day run. I mean, I like to say, like, the first day we met, we stayed up for a week, you know. Yeah, that stuff, that peanut butter shit that I'd been getting here was not what they had out there. Still gives me the willies. So I'm still drinking. But now I'm drinking to take the edge off. Oh, that's me, I did. And I moved to Los Angeles at a point in time when all the boys are dressing like girls and all the bands sound like Poison Warrant, and I show up looking like me. Nobody wants to play with me. Nobody believes that I'm ever going to get a record deal. But I put together a band with a couple of guys from Austin and some other punk rock buddies, and the next thing I know, I got a record deal, and I'm out on tour opening for Guns N' Roses and The Cult and Lynyrd Skynyrd and all these people, and it's awesome and it's amazing, and I'm losing my frickin' mind. You know, by this point, I'm doing an insane amount of meth. We finish our record. The video's on MTV. I'm getting ready to leave on our very first tour. And at this point, I'm partners with a meth cook. I'm dealing fair amounts of meth. And the DEA comes through his front door. His wife calls me while they're in the house. Chris, what do I do? Chris, wrong number. And And my girlfriend and I sat down and we had a conversation. And what we thought the conversation was about was what we were going to stop doing drugs. Because guys like me don't get opportunities like this. I don't look right. I don't act right. The music isn't what everybody else is doing. I've been given an opportunity to do exactly what I want, exactly the way I want to do it. That doesn't happen. And I think we thought we were going to stop doing drugs, at least stop dealing them. I had no idea that we were well and truly past that point. I climbed on a tour bus and spent the next 3 months drinking a fifth of vodka and a case of beer and doing as much blow as I could talk the crew into giving me because they were the only ones getting paid on that tour. And within 2 weeks, she was strung out on heroin because neither of us could just do nothing. And then I came back from the tour and I'm paying for the heroin because by now she doesn't have a job either. And I figure I'm paying for it. I'm going to do it. You know, I've been awake for 8 years. I could use a nap. Meth wasn't doing for me what it had done for me for years. Like, I don't know about you guys, but for me, meth removes all doubt. I'm plagued by self-doubt. I'm plagued by feelings of having no worth and not knowing where I fit. And then I do meth, and I'm a confident motherfucker. I know exactly what needs to happen, and I'm smart enough to make it happen most of the time. You know, but by this point, none of that's happening anymore. I never got the paranoid stuff, you know. And Christ, I got a friend who, after he sobered up, he told me this story. He's living in a small town, and he was a Vietnam War vet. And he grew up in this little town, and he created a trap door in his house. He would crawl out through that trap door and belly crawl out to the bar ditch by the road and shoot tracer rounds back at his own house to try and scare the people who were watching him. And the sheriff, who he went to high school with, would pull up on the road about 10 feet above him and go, "Todd, Todd, go back in the house." And he'd go, "Yes, sir." And like, double time. Because it was the early 90s and that would still happen. But like, I never got that, right? But the meth wasn't working anymore. No amount of it made me sure of who I was anymore. No amount of it. And I couldn't drink enough for the amounts of speed I was doing. And heroin did something for me that none of the other drugs had ever done. It just fixed what was wrong with me. Like, that blackness in my soul went away for a few hours. I was good. I hadn't had that kind of peace in years. Unfortunately, when I would wake up the next day, the hole was just a tiny bit bigger than the day before because the thing I poured into it was caustic. And, you know, heroin was rolling through Los Angeles in the late 80s and early 90s, and everyone was strung out. And there were doctors you could go see, and they would give you a bunch of pills, and you'd climb on the tour bus and kick during the first week of the tour because you can't get heroin on the road. And it's just, it's this on, as long as you're still making money for somebody, nobody cared back then because people hadn't started dying yet. And, but it was a brutal existence. You know, I missed some of the coolest parts of my own life, you know. Like, I look back on it now, like, I have this very distinct memory once at a place in San Francisco in front of about 18,000 people and once at a festival in England in front of twice that many. And I'm out on this little runway, and we're not that big of a band, but we're in a, you know, early, late afternoon spot, and I'm out, and I'm playing a solo, and I'm seeing myself on the Diamond Vision, and people are going, "Ah!" And in my mind, I'm going, "Dude, if I get laid, this will be awesome." It was already awesome. I was completely missing it. I'm sure I did get laid, and I'm also sure I went to bed miserable because I was always miserable. There was no fixing my miserable. I came back to Los Angeles. We were trying to make our third record. Nevermind came out. Nirvana was on the same label I was on. Everybody at the label stopped everything they were doing and stared at their record cover trying to figure out how to take credit for it. And we saw the writing on the wall. We had all been in punk bands, you know. All the guys with nice straight teeth and leather outfits had ruined it for everybody. You know, rock and roll needed a kick in the ass, and Seattle was doing that, but we were going to get lumped in with all that, and it was done. So the band broke up. I got a job working for a fashion accessories designer, because that's what a guy like me ends up doing. I realized about 6 months into doing that job that I was making enough money to stay strung out for the rest of my life. And that was terrifying. Because for all my struggles with God and spirituality when I got here, my motto, the guiding principle in my life at this point was, I don't pray for parking spaces. And what that means is I take care of business, and good stuff happens for me before I even know I need it. But I knew once I started doing heroin, that deal was off. And I wasn't wrong. And so once the record deal went away and all the rest of this, and I was terrified because people around me were starting to overdose. And so I sold my motorcycle and bought a shitty van and put everything would fit into the van, including my ex who wasn't speaking to me. Like you do. Small amount of codependency, I don't know. She stopped talking to me because I wouldn't pay for her dope anymore until I was getting ready to leave, and then she didn't know where she was going to go, so she asked if she could come, and I went, sure. We put everything we owned into this van, and we headed for Texas because my dad said we could come stay with him. It took 5 days to get here because heroin is not a good cross-country drug. Drive a little. Yeah. You know. And then we got here, and we brought a ton of pills to help get through the detox. And we got through the detox in the first week at my dad's house. And there's no alcohol in his house. Van's on its last legs. And about 3 weeks into being back in Austin, my girlfriend had a psychotic episode. She had a break. And we had to call the paramedics. And they kept asking me, what is she on? What did she take? What's she on? And nothing was what she was on. I understand that what she was on was untreated malady. And after 3 weeks, she has this disease more aggressive and virulently than anybody I have ever met in 20 years of sobriety and 20 years of using. And 3 weeks of not treating that disease sent her into a psychotic episode. And they had to medicate her and put her in the hospital for 3 or 4 days. And when she got out of that hospital, we brushed off our Spanish. We headed for Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard, because that's where you go in every city, and start asking questions. And before we knew it, we had found heroin. And once moving didn't help, for me, all bets were off. You know, I was still a producer. I was a guy who got things done. I was a guy who it still looked okay. But once moving didn't help, and I didn't know moving was a thing we do, once coming home didn't help, because apparently there's heroin in Texas. I just stopped caring. I spent every day terrified of dying and wishing I were dead, and that's a reckless way to live. You know, I was too chicken to kill myself, but I didn't care if you killed me, and I didn't care if I overdosed. And every day I'd wake up and think, fuck, not again. You know, I solved this problem yesterday, and now I got to start over. You know, and I kept trying to have jobs. I kept trying to do things and get my feet under me, and I couldn't do it. And I went on methadone, and that didn't help. And to quit methadone, got in a tour bus, that didn't help. And somewhere along the lines, my dealer, you know, I didn't look like a junkie because I was still eating, you know. And he knew that I had firearms, and so he asked me to start if I'd be interested in meeting his cousin who ran a sports book, because he needed somebody to do some collecting, and I thought that sounded like a great opportunity for a nice boy from a good family. And so I said, okay. And I started doing that. Not long after I did that, my 21-year-old roommate got busted with some cocaine, and he thought for sure he was going to prison, so he killed himself in my house. And in order to deal with the dead guy's room, one of my friends said, hey, I'll teach you how to grow weed, since nobody wants to rent a dead guy's room. So I went, okay. So now I'm growing hydroponic weed in the dead guy's room, and I'm going out with a gun several times a week to collect money from rich people. And this is my awesome life. And I'm using so much that I'm overdosing semi-regularly. And then my idiot roommate crawls in the window because he forgot his keys, and somebody sees him and calls the police because they think it's a burglary, and the cops come over and they find everything. But because it was a black and white, not the drug cops, they fucked it all up, and I never got charged. I don't know how that happened. You know, I hid. I didn't go home. I drove past and kept going. But the wheels came off, and the money went away, and I started having to do a lot of stuff that I still don't know how to wrap my head around. You know, the best description of hitting bottom I've ever heard is when your life is getting bad faster than you can lower your standards. And that's, like, I was doing stuff that I couldn't even wrap my head around doing a week ago, and now I'm doing it every day. And I don't see a way out. And I was dead 4 or 5 times. And then I find myself in this moment where I'm sitting at my desk, and I'm working on a pistol for my dad. My dad's a gun collector, but he's getting old, and I'm putting sights on a competition pistol for him, and my dealer shows up, and I find myself sitting at my desk with a bunch of dope in one hand and a gun in the other one, trying to decide which one to use. And it wasn't, I don't know about you guys, I used to do this thing all the time, going, why doesn't somebody save me? I don't get this. But it wasn't that. It was just me sitting there and calmly trying to decide which one to use, today or forever. And for just a minute, I was all the way across the room looking at my own back, going, how the fuck did those become my only choices? I used to have a life. I used to have stuff. I was on fucking MTV for a minute. What, and now this is it? Really? There has to be something else, and I have no freaking idea what it is. And then later that day, and I always joke, I don't know how much later because I didn't use the gun. I'm changing channels on the TV, and I come across this episode of 2020, the news magazine, and they're doing a feature about this jazz saxophone player. And since I'm a little kid, it's hard to imagine now with the internet and everything else, but when I was a little kid, there was no information about music. You had a record cover, you had a magazine that came out once in a while, and if the band came, you got to go see them actually moving at the show. And sometimes things would be on television. But anytime anything on television, I don't care, you know, the freaking Bugaloos, the Sonny and Cher variety show, I don't care. I'm watching it. It's music. It's the best I got. So I'm channel surfing, and I see it's jazz sax player, and I don't give a crap about jazz, but music, whatever, I'll watch. And they're talking about this guy, and he played with all the greats in the 50s and the early 60s, and then they say, and he was a heroin addict for 30 years. I'm going, well, that's a weird thing to include. But it turned out the story wasn't about his musical career. It was about the fact that he was 10 years sober, and he had just founded an organization funded by the Grammys to pay for musicians to go to treatment. And I went, oh, my God, this is my shot. I didn't know this place was here. I didn't know anybody that was sober. Like, I knew a few people, but they had disappeared. I thought they were dead. You know, they weren't hanging out with us anymore. I didn't know what my resources were. I didn't know about anything. But I see this thing on TV, and I run in the other room, and I get on my computer, and I search for the place. And 4 minutes later, the website comes up because there's one tiny picture, and it's 1998. A lot of AOL, right? Those of you laughing are giving away your age. And I got on the phone, and I would love to say I was open and I was teachable and they scooped me up. But I had just registered for school because what I needed was a career and some structure. And they wanted me to go to treatment for 30 days, and school started in 27 days. And I wanted to know if I could leave a couple days early so I didn't miss the first day of class. And they said, call us back when you really want to go. And I went, okay. So I got through the next month doing what I had to do, and I went to school for about 10 days and called them up and said, I'm ready to go now. And so they put me in touch with a treatment center in the Hill Country. And when I talked to the treatment center, they found out I was on methadone. And they told me, we can't take you on methadone. You'll be so sick from detoxing from that that you won't get anything out of your 30 days with us. So why don't you just stop taking that methadone and we'll see you in 6 weeks. And what they were saying, without saying it out loud for liability reasons, is go back to full-time heroin use because that's a detox we can manage. So I did. And that was the second gift. The TV show was the first gift. The second gift was having to spend 6 weeks working without a net. Like, if I don't come up with the money, if the dude doesn't return my phone call, I'm in real trouble because I'm in deep. And I'm overdosing all the time, and I'm just trying to get there. And then somewhere along the way, a week or two before I went, I got what amounted to the third gift, which was my ex, who was just as strung out as me. I say ex. We had split up several years before, but we kept running into each other in the same parking lots. And we would end up in one, you know, back together for a minute until it inevitably turned into what it always turned into. But she sat me down and she said, look, you need to think about why you're going to treatment. Because I'm terrified that if it doesn't work, next time you OD, you'll die for good. And so you really have to think about why you're going. And neither of us knew anything about recovery. But I sat down and I did. I went, why am I going? I mean, am I going because I keep overdosing? Am I going because I can't function? Am I going because I keep getting arrested? Why am I going? And I realized that I wasn't going for any of those reasons. I was going because I had to believe that there was a way to function in this world without that chemical in my body. And I did not know what it was. All the rest of that stuff didn't matter. And I'm glad that she asked me that, because I realized that if I was going for any of those reasons, what I was really looking for was manageability. And once I got that back, I'd probably try using again. Why I was going to treatment was because I desperately needed to find a way to live where I did not need to be heavily sedated just to function. And so I went. It was rocky in the beginning. You know, the detox wasn't fun. I remember struggling up the hill to my first on-campus 12-step meeting 4 days into the detox. I'm still pretty cloudy. Somebody starts talking about God. My head clears up for just a second. I go, oh, crap! And then it just, it's all fuzzy again. It's like, where am I? Fucking church camp. This is great. You know? And as I came to, I started going to the step classes. You know, they had some guys in long-term recovery who were teaching classes about the first four steps. And I sat down with this guy who was very influential on my early sobriety, and he explained the first step to me. I heard a lot of people say they did the first step when they were out there. I did research, but I had no idea what I was studying, you know. And he explained the powerlessness to me, that I have this inability, if I'm an addict or an alcoholic, I have this inability to always control how much I drink and use once I start. You know, I'm not powerless over everything. That would be nice. It means I have no responsibilities. You know, I'm not powerless over people, places, and things. Or I am, but none of that matters because so is everybody else. But most people have the ability to choose how much they drink and use, and I don't. And my life is unmanageable, not because of the chaos of my life in addiction, but because when I try to make a decision to stop, I can't manage that decision. You know, that I have to look at my own history. Do I believe that this is who I am? Can I admit that to my innermost self? And he helped me look at my relationship to things like weed and beer, which I was hanging on to because I got to have something, right? And it got me to a place where I could let go entirely. And then I spent 2 weeks arguing about whether or not God existed with other people at a mental facility because the big book said God either is or he isn't, and we figured religion needed to know. And I was terrified because I was meeting people who were long-term sober who worked there, and I believed that the program would work. But I was terrified that in order for it to work, I was going to have to come to believe something that I knew I was never going to believe. I'm never going to believe in God. I know that. And then one of the guys that worked there said, it's not important. What you believe is really most just an impediment to going and getting an experience with the world. You know, don't have beliefs. Have ideas. People get real busy killing and dying protecting beliefs, but ideas are changeable. Look at your ideas. Go get some experience with this power. In my experience with the second step, I stopped arguing when a guy who worked there was covered in tattoos, an old biker dude, sat me down and asked me if I thought he was just better at staying sober than me. If he was just not using. You think I'm just not using for 10 years? I went, no. And as I came to believe that he was connecting to some sort of a power by working the steps, I came to believe that maybe I could too. And I realized in hindsight that I started having faith that if I started doing what Ray was doing, I could start getting what Ray was getting. You know, I also knew that everybody who was at the treatment center for their umpteenth treatment episode hadn't done a fourth step. And whatever that is, I need to fucking get on with that. You know, my first fourth step is an interesting work of unguided fiction, really. You know, even the first two columns aren't super clear. And whatever I did in the third and fourth column, I just made shit up. There was no structure to it at all. But my sponsor knew where I needed to go, and he led me to my part. You know, when I got out of treatment, I went to different meetings every day until I stumbled into a meeting with a guy who I had known in my 20s. Our bands played together, and he was at this meeting, and he was just doing what he did every day. He was going to a meeting, hanging out with his buddies, trying to support his recovery. He was a couple years sober at the time. But I was starting to lose hope because I couldn't find my people. You know, I was still seeing differences and not similarities. You know, I was finding a lot of old rednecks and hippies and businessmen, and you know, I couldn't find my people, but my people were all still strung out. They were also calling each other, going, why do you go to rehab? What's he doing? And then they went on with their business, and 2 years later, they all turned up. I'm older than them, you know. But he was just doing what he was doing, just going to a meeting. But because I saw him in that meeting, I sat down and I stayed. He may have saved my life that day. I was losing hope of finding my people. But he was just there going about his business. And I know that I've returned that favor of people because they've told me. They walked in hoping nobody, you know, trying to go someplace nobody would see them. And they walked in, saw me, and went, God damn it, now I have to stay. Fair enough, you know. So I kept working the steps. I was told early on, move fast. Don't try to understand what you're doing. Just do it. Understand it in hindsight. My sponsor was fond of saying the only way to understand anything is through experience and examining the experience. I can't remember who it was at that early home group who said that, you know, it's like skydiving. You'd be fascinated by skydiving. You could read magazines about skydiving, and you could learn to fold parachutes and go hang out at the airport and even go to meetup groups of people who skydive. But until you jump out of the plane, you don't know fucking anything about skydiving, you know. And working the steps is the same. I have a lot of fear. I have a lot of opinions. I have no experience. So I just need to get busy and get some experience. And I found some people that felt like I belong, and they encouraged me to keep going. And I remember sitting down with my sponsor at about 120 days sober. I'm almost done with the amends that I can make right off the bat. And I'm starting to work. Well, no, I'm not. I'm trying to do 10, 11, and 12 without asking for direction, so literally not much is happening. But I remember sitting with him and going, dude, I think the promises are happening. I think all that stuff, I think it's happening. I mean, I think the program's working in me. And he looked at me and went, no, it isn't. I said, what? And he said, you're better than you've been in 20 years. And you're still so far from good, it freaks me out every time I see you. And instead of getting upset by that, I was going, oh, it gets better than this? He said, oh, absolutely. Please don't settle for just not hurting. Please keep working the steps. Please keep growing, because there's so much beyond just not hurting. And I'm grateful for that, because I couldn't have lived in that gray indefinitely. Some people do. I can't stay sober in that. At some point, my sobriety had to stop being motivated by fear of going back from where I came from and start being motivated by being excited about where I'm headed. You know, and that takes action and experience and doing things that scare me so that my life can get better, not just so they can stay even. You know, I've done a lot of work. I'm still doing a lot of work. You know, the first couple of years, there was, you know, it was a long period of reconstruction. You know, it took me 2 years to get a bank account because of some of the shit I did. Nobody would give me a bank account. You know, it took a long time to clean up my credit and other stuff that I thought, you know, I wasn't planning on living. I didn't pay my taxes, you know, or brush my teeth, you know. If I knew I was going to live this long, I would have worked out once in a while, you know. You know, the running joke at my house is my body is like a demolition derby car from the 90s, and I'm trying to turn it back into a daily driver while I'm driving it. Hey, a part fell off. I got to fix it while we're going. But then at some point, I realized I had no marketable skills, and that terrified me, but it meant I had to go back to school. And so I did a bunch of fear inventory around that and went back to school, which was good because while I was in school, the job I had that paid me real good disappeared, and I became homeless for a minute. But I finished school, and what they had trained me to do is what I did for the next 10 years, doing freelance work and supporting myself in a wonderful manner. It was awesome. I did a ton of work around relationships, so I would stop picking the most broken person in the room and then leaning into one of their cracks until they split open on me, turning my apartment into a treatment center with a staff of one, you know. Because I knew I wanted a long-term relationship, and I knew I didn't know how to do that, and there was work to be done. And I did it because I was unwilling. I was dangerously close to believing the lie that I just needed to be single if that was going to be easier. But that would have been a lie for me. And I'm glad I did the work because I was terrified of it, but it's given me this unbelievable marriage. You know. And I don't think our marriage is special. I think any two people who are living life the way we're living it get to have the kind of thing we're having. It gets easier every year. It's the dumbest thing. We just look at each other and go, I can't think of anything I don't like about you. It's fucking like this long, I should hate something, like that little laugh or something, nothing. We just love each other all the time. You know, life just keeps getting bigger. You know, when you get sober and you stop burning your fucking life down, life just starts getting bigger. And if I do work the steps on new things as they come up, I can build a foundation to support those new things. And the only choice is I work the steps and build the foundation to support the new stuff, or I kill the new growth. You will totally see people in meetings doing that. You know, I met a guy when I first got sober who used to be a high-paid lawyer who was working at Thundercloud Subs. You know, he was 5 years sober at the time. He still works there 20 years later because he's terrified of going back into his high-paid, high-stress profession. I didn't get sober to let fear run my life. I didn't get sober to hide out in some AA club. I want to have the biggest, coolest life I can have. But everything has to be on the table, everything. I thought my musical career was over. I mean, the last record I made with a bunch of junkies. And when it started selling in Europe, we hired a punk band to go to Europe and pretend they were us because we were all too strung out. And they did. They took one of the, singers from the band and went over there and did the entire tour as though they were us. You know, I thought music's over. But 9 months into my sobriety, I got contacted by a record label who wanted to release an unreleased live record from the band I was in the late 80s and early 90s. And so I found myself flying out to California to mix this record. And somehow or another, word had spread, and somebody from a band from Seattle heard that we were getting back together. And so they called and asked if we wanted to open this, two or three night stand at the House of Blues. And we had literally not talked about being a band again. But we went, screw it, why not? And that was awesome fun. And then we got another phone call and we did something else. And the next thing I know, I'm in Europe on tour. And then I'm in Japan on tour. And I'm getting to do all these things that I thought were over and gone. But I'm being present for them and I'm getting to experience them and do them the right way and for the right reasons. And after a while, my health got to a place where that was more trouble than it was worth, and I stopped doing it. They're still out there running and gunning, and if they're enjoying it, that's awesome. I'm super glad I'm not in a van in any part of the world. And life just keeps going, and life just keeps going, and it hands me new challenges. And I walk outside of the 12-step world every 3 or 4 years and have conversations with people from other spiritual walks just to get their input on what they're discovering on their path and what I'm discovering on mine and seeing how where the parallels are. And in 2015, I had a conversation with a Buddhist monk and a Hindu priest and this guy that I've been talking to on and off for 15 years who teaches at the Episcopal Seminary. And in all those conversations, this thing came up that one of them referred to as the other side of humility. And what he meant was, humility means right-sized. And in the 12-step world, we're mostly talking about stop doing the thing only God can do and start doing the things only you can do. You know, I'm running around trying to control things, thinking it's going to manufacture the spiritual power I need to feel whole, and it doesn't ever. I have to let God manufacture that power. I have to take the actions to clear a path so that I can connect with that power. But there's another piece of right-sized, because every single one of us, every person in the world is born with a talent. And all that really means is something that you're good at, something that comes easily to you that doesn't come easily to your friends. The kind of thing that when you do it, you go, anybody can do this. And then your friends go, yeah, not me. You know, and it may be something big and showy that people go, ooh, when you do it. Or it may be something little and quiet. But everyone has a talent that's innate to who they are. And this guy said, it's at some point or another, it becomes my job to start asking, what is that in me and how might I develop it? And one of the things that came up in the conversation was, since I got sober, people have told me that when I talk about spirituality and when I talk about the steps, I do it in a way that's different than other people. And I never knew what to do with that. Like, if you told me my band was great, I would tell you thank you, because I worked very hard to make that good. But this, I don't know what to do with that. And the Hindu priest said, well, then that means it's a talent. What are you going to do with that? I said, well, I'm already doing this. And he's going, yeah, I don't think one at a time is how you're supposed to express that. And so I came home in November of 2015 and started going, what do I do? And talking with my wife and like, where do I go with this? I mean, is it a podcast? Is it what am I doing? And then the first week of January, I run into an old friend that I sobered up with who's on the board here. And he says, oh, now I know why I came to this meeting. I need to talk to you. And he asked me if I'll come work here, which was a terrible idea at the time. I was leaving a good-paying job with a company that was growing for a company that was $4 million in debt, and we were going down the tubes. But it was so obvious that it was the next step for me. Not the last step, but it was where I needed to go next, to start using this thing that comes naturally to me. You know, before I sobered up, I never talked, like ever. I'm the quiet one in my family. So you guys have met Andrew, my brother. But I'm doing this. It was terrifying in the beginning. It's still a little terrifying. I have no training. There's no letters after my name. But it's taken 3 years of doing it to finally realize that I have some value, that I'm making a difference. So, but I don't think I'm done. You know, this for the last year, people keep coming up to me and go, and now what? And now what? I mean, what do you mean, and now what? I'm comfortable. It's going, yeah, and now what? You know, it's time to do something else. Time to take on a larger, you know, it's great that you're helping 500 people a year out there at that place. What about 1,000? What about 10,000? How would you do that? I was going, leave me alone. I don't want to be seen like, but people won't leave me alone. So now I'm having to try and figure out what to do next. I don't know what that is. You know, somebody said, write a book. I was going, I write songs, 25 words or less my whole life. I don't know how to do that. I said, oh, we'll help. Fuck. I don't know where this is going. And it's slightly scary. You know, I had gastric sleeve surgery in January because I was 130 pounds, 140 pounds overweight, and I'm 58 years old, and there's not a lot of 340-pound 70-year-olds. And the ones that are crippled, you know, and it's like, I remember at 45 years old seeing an interview, Bob Costas interviewed this man who was 92 years old, and for 47 years he was the announcer for the Detroit Tigers baseball team. And he was diagnosed with something terminal besides being 92. But he was still having a great life. He was going, yeah, I understand the last month or two are going to be bad, but I'm still good now. I'm like, and I watched him, and for the first time in my life, I went, dude, I want to be 92. You know, I just learned how to live. I just learned a really successful, reproducible way for walking through life and meeting whatever comes up in front of me, good, bad, or otherwise. It would be great if 45 was the middle. Like I said, I spent all day, every day in the 90s, terrified of dying and wishing I were dead. And now I spend every day not afraid of dying and being excited to live. And it's just because I do this stuff. You know, and I'm not special. You know, the results I get are the same results everybody gets who really, truly does this. Like, I'm dumbfounded by the people who read the book and then literally never do what it says. I'm not making this shit up. I have brought some things to the table and some clarity that might not be directly in the book, but the guy who wrote the book had 3 years and I have 20. I've been doing it. If he wrote it when he was 20 years sober, I'm sure he'd have put that shit in there too. You know. But if you want your version of my life, you just got to do what I'm doing. You know, it's cumbersome at first. It feels awkward. It makes you feel dumb. But if you keep doing it, it becomes muscle memory. And it's just how I live my life now. I can't imagine trying to figure out what to do in a situation without inventory and prayer and meditation. I wouldn't even try. It's like, Jesus Christ, hoping for the best is the single stupidest thing people like us can do. You know, I need a better plan, something reproducible. And I found that in the steps. You know, I can't wait. I always get teary thinking about you guys. The things that are possible for you blow my fucking mind. And yet I bury you all the fucking time. You know? I just want to walk by you. Just go. You know? It's so good if you can just get through the rough spot. Where you are now, it's like we've told you, you can't drink or use anymore ever successfully. So you have to let go of that, but you don't have any experience with the new solution yet. And you're standing here holding nothing, and it's terrifying, and I get it. But if you don't get busy getting the solution, you will go back to what you know when you get uncomfortable enough. Throw yourself into this with the same desperation you sought dope. I never once said, fuck, I'm uncomfortable. Tomorrow or the next day, I'm going to call my dealer. But we do that with our sponsor of the Step Work all the goddamn time. You know, there's literally no point for enduring the misery ever. You know, I don't remember where I heard it, but I believe that the steps will do for me slowly what a shot of dope did for me quickly. And I got to be willing to stay consistent and keep my feet moving. I have to keep going because the alternative is death and not a quick one. I mean, I lived by the motto for years, live fast, die young. But like I always say, I never did the numbers. You know, most of us don't die young. Most of us just wake up at 40 with a horrendous drug problem and half our teeth missing and no job skills. And then we got to go fix that shit. You know, I didn't get sober because I was afraid of dying. I got sober because I was afraid of living the way I was living for another 10 or 15 years. I couldn't do it. And no matter how much I didn't want to do what was the program was putting in front of me, I didn't want to go back to the last month of my using more. And so that motivated me in the beginning until I could get some results. You know, I'm excited for you. I can't wait to see you. I've had the pleasure of watching some of you for three plus years now. There's a lot of people in this room with 1 and 2 and 3 years of sobriety who were not, I would never have put money on. Jesus Christ, that one's cooked like a motherfucker. You know, I see people come in here that look like ghosts. They've been homeless for 10 years, and now they're out there kicking ass and taking names and having jobs and doing wonderful, having wonderful lives only because they're really doing this, because somehow or another this time they believed it would work. You know, if you can just suspend your beliefs around whether this works or not, what God means, all the rest of that stuff, and just lean into it, anything's possible. You know, and I can't wait to see where this takes you, and I really hope I get to be there for it. Thanks, guys.